Journey to the West, Chapter 9.
We're looking at Chapter 9 of the, well, the very renowned Chinese novel, Journey to the West.
And most people know it for, you know, the Monkey King, Sun Wukong, the demons.
Yeah, the big adventures.
Exactly. But it's just packed with these incredible philosophical moments, sort of hidden gems.
And we're focusing on one of those today.
Yeah, a seemingly simple conversation. It's between a fisherman and a woodcutter.
Okay, and the setting is pretty important here, isn't it?
Crucial. We're outside the magnificent capital city, Chang'an. This is Tang Dynasty China.
Right. Specifically, the text mentions the 13th year of Emperor Taizong's reign.
And the source really paints a picture of Chang'an. It's not just any city.
No, it's described as like the center of the world, built over generations.
Mm-hmm. Surrounded by these famous 8 rivers and 4 mountains. It's bustling, you know, flower lanes, orchestral buildings.
The absolute peak of worldly success and grandeur.
That's the backdrop. But our characters, Zhang Xiao, he's the fisherman.
And Li Ding, the woodcutter?
Yeah, they aren't part of that world, not really. The text has this great description.
Oh yeah, the scholars who didn't pass the exams.
Exactly. And mountain men who knew how to read.
So they're educated, they understand that world, but they've kind of opted out.
Pretty much. They've chosen a different path.
Yeah.
We actually meet them just after they've been into Chang'an.
Right. They've sold their fish, their firewood.
And now they're walking back home along the Jing River, maybe enjoying a little wine they bought.
So the whole thing kicks off with Zhang Xiao, the fisherman, right? He really sets the stage.
He does. He draws this immediate, really stark contrast. He looks at the people inside the city chasing success.
And the language is strong. He says people pursuing fame, they perish for it.
And those after profit, they die for it.
I know.
Seeking status. That's like sleeping with a tiger.
Mm-hmm.
Constant danger.
And chasing favor from the powerful.
Like carrying away a snake. You're going to get bitten eventually.
So right away, worldly ambition is framed as just incredibly dangerous.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then he pivots. He compares that life to their own.
Which he calls free and easy.
Mm-hmm. Just enjoying what's around them. The water show, the mountain green.
Living contentedly with, you know, not very much. Letting life just happen.
It's a powerful opening statement. They've seen the alternative, maybe even been tempted by it, who knows, but they've consciously rejected it.
They see the risks. But then Li Ding, the woodcutter, he agrees, but he adds a little twist.
Yeah, a bit of friendly competition creeps in. He says basically, okay, I agree with the principle, but Brother Zhang, your water show isn't quite as good as my mountain green.
Hmm. And Zhang Xiao has to defend his turf, naturally.
Of course. And this friendly debate, this comparison, becomes the framework for the whole exchange. They start using poetry.
Different poetic forms to champion their own way of life.
Highlighting the specific joys, the freedoms that each environment gives them.
And it's not just vague boasting, is it? They get incredibly specific. They start with a form called Tua Mia, Butterfly Loves Flowers.
Right. The fisherman, Zhang Xiao, he describes his life. Small boat, vast water, just leaning back, listening to nature.
Sounds peaceful.
Very. He stresses being free from worry, fame, profit. His happiness is simple. Gathering plants, being with his wife and child, sleeping soundly.
No honor, disgrace, or trouble.
Exactly. Then the woodcutter, Li Ding, uses the same form. Butterfly loves flowers, but for the mountains.
So what's his picture?
Pine flowers, clouds, listening to orioles singing. He talks about the seasons, the warmth of spring, the quick change of autumn, enjoying it all.
His seems more about vibrant freedom, uncontrolled nature.
I think so. It's maybe tranquility on the water versus a kind of wilder freedom in the mountains. Both good, but different flavors.
So it's not just where they are, but the kind of life that place allows.
Precisely. Then they shift gears. They start describing the actual stuff they get from their lives, the goods.
Using another poetic form.
Yeah, partridge sky.
Okay, so what are the fisherman's goods?
He lists his bounty. This sounds delicious, actually. Fresh fish, green turtle, purple crab, red shrimp.
All from the water?
Directly. Plus water celery, lotus root, water chestnuts. His boat is his home, the water village his livelihood. He's literally fed by his environment.
And the woodcutter's partridge sky. What's on his menu?
A mountain feast. Preserved chicken, goose, deer, rabbit, which he claims are better than the fisherman's catch, naturally.
A bit of one-upmanship there.
Definitely. Plus mountain vegetables like tun leaves, bamboo shoots, and fruits like plums, peaches, pears. His home is a grass hut up high.
So again, different kinds of abundance, but it's natural abundance tied to their place. Nothing like the gold and silver chased in Chang'an.
Not at all. It's about self-sufficiency. Then they move on to describe their freedom.
How do they frame that?
Using the form T, celestial immortal. The fisherman talks about his boat going wherever he wants, totally fearless on the water.
He fishes, nets his catch.
And eats it simply. No fancy sauces needed. He says it's delicious as is. And if he has extra fish.
He takes it to Chang'an.
Yeah, but not to get rich. Just to trade it for some wine.
Huh. To get drunk and sleep soundly in his straw cape.
Exactly. Zero desire for worldly honor or wealth. Total freedom from that ambition.
Okay. And the woodcutter's freedom. His celestial immortal.
It's about independence. In his quiet mountain huts. Surrounded by plants, he loves pine, bamboo, plum, orchid.
He finds firewood.
And nobody bothers him. He sells it when he wants, however much he wants, depending on the world's needs that day.
And uses the money for wine, too.
Whenever he feels like it. Drinks from simple earthenware bowls. Sleeps under a pine tree when he's drunk.
Complete lack of entanglement. No harm comes to him from worldly worries.
That's the core of it. These aren't lives of poverty in their eyes. They're lives of chosen independence. Their work directly fuels simple joys, bypassing the city's complex systems.
Right. It's a different kind of economy, almost.
Mm.
Which leads them to talk about their actual work, their business.
Mm-hmm. In the form, West River Moon.
The fisherman's poem sounds quite beautiful here.
It is. Moonlight on the water, reeds in the wind, the river reflecting stars. But it's also practical. He talks about netting big fish, hooking lots of poach.
So he's successful at his work.
Yes, but the point isn't just the catch. It's what comes after. Cooking it simply and then laughing, joking by river slakes.
So the work is part of the enjoyment, not separate from it.
Exactly. It's integrated. Now, the woodcutter's West River Moon is maybe a bit more rugged.
How so?
He describes the physical reality paths covered in leaves, finding fallen wood, worm-eaten willow, broken pine, gathering vines for rope. It sounds tough. Definitely. Collecting fuel for winter. But the end result is the same. He exchanges it for wine and money as he pleases.
On his own terms.
Always on his own terms.
Does.
Tied to nature cycles, demanding work, but leading to sustenance and simple pleasure, controlled by him.
So we see the work, but it's work they control, connected directly to the world around them. Okay, there's one more poetic form in this sort of debate, right?
Yeah, so immortal at the river. And here they talk about their elegance.
Elegance. How does a fisherman describe elegance?
It's fascinating. He finds it in solitude, moving his boat with the tide, stopping to sing late at night. He paints this picture. Just him, his straw cape, the waning moon.
Too peaceful, doesn't even disturb the birds.
Right. His elegance is in having absolutely nothing to prove, no obligations. He arranges his life exactly how he wants.
And he makes a direct comparison, doesn't he?
He does. He explicitly asks, how can those court officials, waiting around at dawn for audiences, possibly be as free, as truly elegant as him?
That's throwing down the gauntlet to the official definition of status. What about the woodcutter's elegance?
His immortal at the river finds elegance in the mountain's roughness, carrying his axe up a path in autumn, coming home in the cool evening.
With wild flowers in his hair.
Yeah, finding his way by pushing clouds aside. His elegance is in the simple, happy homecoming. His wife, his child welcoming him.
The simple meal, the straw bed, the new wine.
It's an elegance of authenticity, connection to family, connection to nature. Nothing to do with silks or palaces.
So through all these poems, they've basically argued that their lives, which might look humble from the outside,
are actually incredibly rich.
Rich in tangible things. Food, freedom, meaningful work, and this deep sense of personal peace and, yeah, elegance.
An elegance that status can't buy. It's really powerful how they use these different images, water versus mountain, but arrive at such a similar place.
Yeah, the debate isn't really about who's better, is it? It's more a celebration of choosing a life lived authentically.
Absolutely. And they really drive this home when they decide to stop debating and link verses together.
Ah, so they start combining their perspectives.
Exactly, weaving elements from both their worlds into one unified statement about what really matters.
What sort of things come up in the linked verses?
Well, they literally link their settings. Boat in green water, house in deep mountain. It shows connection. They love stream bridges and mountain mists.
Practical things too.
Yeah, cooking fish, burning firewood. Different actions, same goal, providing for themselves. And importantly, they keep coming back to avoiding strife, avoiding gossip.
Contrasting their peace with the conflict you'd find in the pursuit of power.
Definitely. They list simple daily acts, drying nets, sharpening axes, fishing alone, meeting no one on the mountain paths, drinking wine with family, teaching their sons useful skills.
Sharpening an axe, mending a net, real-world skills.
It becomes this tapestry of simple, independent living. And they state their values very clearly.
Like what?
Befriending pine and plum symbols of integrity, endurance, not calculating fame or profit. They mention not even hearing the sound of war.
Wow. Their world is that separate, that peaceful.
Their lives are full of these small, specific joys. Good wine, simple food like wild vegetable soup. They talk about finding joy in every season by following nature's rhythm.
Whether you're on the lake or in the mountains.
And they even elevate their simple work. Gathering firewood has an immortal spirit. Fishing has no worldly form. It's almost spiritual.
They're finding transcendence in the everyday.
You could say that.
Yeah.
And it builds to some really potent lines near the end of the linked verses.
The ones comparing their lives to the city.
Yeah. They say a peaceful body that doesn't need to talk about being a three duke.
Yeah.
You know, the highest officials.
Right.
And a calm nature that's stronger than a 10-mile city wall. They literally weigh city defense and official duty against their lives.
And find their own lives superior.
It's a complete flipping of the usual status hierarchy. Their conclusion is just gratitude.
Thanking heaven and earth for the path they're on.
Exactly. Loving the mountains and water is rare, it's precious, and they bow to each other. Not as winner and loser, but as fellow travelers.
Fellow discoverers of contentment.
That's a good way to put it. It's a beautiful synthesis. Different settings, same core values, same resulting peace.
Zhang Shao and a leading.
And they're saying goodbye, heading off to work.
And their goodbyes are, well, they've got a bit of an edge to them, haven't they?
They do. Zhang Shao warns Li Ding, you know, watch out for tigers on the mountain.
Yeah, even jokes, kind of darkly, that if Li Ding runs into trouble, tomorrow the streets will be missing an old friend. Ouch.
But Li Ding gives as good as he gets. He fires back, basically, hey, the sea's dangerous too. You might not make it back either.
So it's friendly banter, but underneath you feel the real dangers they face every day.
Definitely. But then Zhang Xiao says something interesting. He claims he's actually guaranteed to be safe out on the water.
Which makes Li Ding stop, like guaranteed. How
exactly. Li Ding's skeptical, says something like, heaven's unpredictable. People have good days and bad days. How can you guarantee safety?
And this is where Zhang Xiao spills the beans, right?
Yeah.
His secret.
Yeah. He says every day he goes to this fortune teller in Chang'an City.
Okay.
And for the price of one golden carp, just one fish, this fortune teller gives him an exact prediction. The source calls it Eliwata. Basically, hits every time.
Hits every time. On what?
On where to fish.
Yeah.
Tells him exactly where to go, how to cast his net, everything. Guarantees the catch.
Wow. So he's completely confident, thinks he'll just stroll back tomorrow, sell his fish, meet Li Ding again, easy.
Total confidence. But here's the twist. As he's saying all this, bragging about his foolproof method, the source says, this was speaking on the road and someone was in the grass. Someone's listening.
Okay, that's ominous. Who?
Not just anyone. It's a water patrolling yaksha, you know, a kind of spirit or minor deity from the Jing River Dragon King's palace.
A yaksha overhearing a fisherman.
Right. Seems random, but this yaksha hears the boast about the fortune teller's perfect accuracy, and it's immediately alarmed.
Alarmed? Why? Because the guy's catching too many fish.
It's deeper than that. The yaksha rushes back to the Dragon King of the Jing River and reports what it heard.
Okay, so what's the big deal for the Dragon King?
Well, the yaksha explains it. If this human fortune teller can predict things that accurately,
yeah,
it means he can basically see into the workings of the Water Kingdom. He knows where the fish and, well, all the aquatic creatures will be.
Ah, I see. It's not just about the fish stocks.
Exactly. The Yaksha's worry, straight from the text, is like, if he's always right, won't all our subjects get caught? How can the water mansion stay grand? How can we, you know, make waves and support the king's power?
So this human's knowledge is seen as a direct threat to the Dragon King's authority, his power over his own realm.
Precisely. A simple prediction, or the claim of one, challenges the king's control.
So the Dragon King hears this, and I imagine he's not pleased.
Furious is more like it. The text says his immediate reaction is, grab sword, go to Chang'an, kill the fortune teller.
Whoa, okay. Straight to violence.
Pretty much. But his court, his son, grandson, ministers, the whole underwater council, they urge him to maybe take a breath.
They advise caution. Why?
It's interesting. They warn him that just, you know, showing up and making it rain or causing a storm out of anger over a big city like Chang'an,
yeah,
That's a big no-no. It could disturb the humans, sure, but more importantly, it could tick off the higher-ups, bring down heavenly wrath.
Oh, right. So even a Dragon King has bosses, essentially. There's a cosmic hierarchy.
You got it. So they suggest a different plan.
Which is?
Disguise.
Mm-hmm.
Transform into a scholar the text uses, like a refined gentleman scholar, and go check this guy out discreetly first.
Smart. Reconnaissance before reaction.
Exactly. See if this fortune teller is really that good, then decide what to do.
And the Dragon King goes for it.
He does. He changes himself into a white-robed scholar. The description paints him as, you know, looking very distinguished, proper manners, speaks eloquently like he knows his Confucian classics.
Looks the part. Even mentions his specific clothes.
Right. So he travels to Chang'an, heads to Westgate Street, where the Yaksha said the fortune teller was.
He there.
Oh, yeah. He finds a crowd buzzing outside talking about astrology and predictions.
Yeah.
Confirms he's in the right spot.
So he goes inside the shop.
He pushes through the crowd and looks in. And the place isn't some, you know, dusty little booth.
No.
The source describes it as pretty luxurious. Walls decked out with pearls and jewels, fine embroidery everywhere, art by famous painters, fancy inkstones, brushes, stacks of divination books.
Okay, so this isn't just some random street vendor. This is a serious operation.
Very serious. And the man himself is introduced, Yuan Chaoqing.
Yuan Chaoqing.
The text specifically says he's the uncle of Yuan Tiangang, who is a real, very famous court astronomer and diviner.
Ah, so divination runs in the family. And this Yuan Chaoqing is supposed to be good.
The best in Chang'an, according to the source.
Uh-huh.
His skill tops the capital.
And what skills are we talking about?
The list is pretty impressive. Master of complex methods like Lu Yao, Bagua, understands heaven, earth, ghosts, spirits, can map out cosmic patterns, sees the past, the future.
Wow.
Predicts prosperity, decline, good luck, bad luck, life, death. The text even uses hyperbole, saying like, when he speaks, wind and rain obey. When he writes, spirits are startled.
Okay, so he's presented as having almost supernatural levels of knowledge.
Absolutely. Not just a clever predictor, but someone deeply connected to the workings of the cosmos.
So the Dragon King, in his scholar disguise, walks in.
Yep. Exchanges some polite words, then gets down to business. He asks Yuan Chaoqing for a prediction.
About what?
About the weather.
Mm.
Simple enough, right? Will it be cloudy or clear?
Okay, seems like a safe test.
Yuan doesn't even blink. Gives an immediate answer. Something like, clouds will cover the peaks, fog in the forests, rain is coming tomorrow.
Just like that, rain tomorrow.
The king pushes him. Maybe trying to catch him out, maybe genuinely curious how specific he can be. Asks, okay, when tomorrow and how much rain?
Ah, the crucial details.
And this is the moment. Yuan Chaoqing gives this unbelievably precise forecast.
Talk precise.
He says, tomorrow at Chen hour, that's 7, 9 a.m., clouds will gather. At sea hour 9:11 a.m., thunder will roll. At Wu hour 11 a.m., 1 p.m., the rain will start.
Oh, yeah.
And at Wei hour 1:03 p.m., the rain will stop.
Whoa, down to the two-hour window for each stage.
And he's not done. He gives the exact amount. Total rainfall will be 3 feet, 3 inches, and 48 points.
That's insane. How could anyone know that? Especially about rain, which is the Dragon King's whole thing.
Exactly. The Dragon King hears this, and, well, the text says he laughs. He just can't believe this human claims to know his business better than he does.
So he challenges him.
Right then and there, he proposes a formal bet.
Okay, what are the terms?
The king says, look, if it happens exactly like you said, clouds, thunder, rain starts, rain stops, all at the right times, and the amount is precisely 3 feet, 3 inches, 48 points, then I'll pay you 50 taels of gold.
50 taels? That's a lot of money, right?
A significant sum, yeah. A real reward if he's right.
But if he's wrong, even slightly.
And the king gets drastic. He says, if you're off by even a little bit, wrong time, wrong amount, no rain at all, I will personally tear down your sign, smash up your shop, and run you out of Chang'an for being a charlatan, a liar.
Wow. So his entire livelihood, his reputation, everything is on the line.
Everything. Based on this one, incredibly specific prediction.
And how does Yuan Chaoqing react? Does he flinch? Try to hedge his bets?
Nope. The source says he happily or maybe readily accepts the terms, just like that.
Complete confidence. He doesn't seem worried at all.
Not a shred of doubt described. He accepts the wager.
So the Dragon King leaves. Bet made.
Bet made. He heads back to his water palace under the Jing River. His court is waiting, eager to hear what happened.
And he tells him about the prediction and the bet.
He recounts the whole thing. Probably still thinking this Yuan Chaoqing guy is just some fast-talking fraud.
And what does the court think? His ministers, his family?
They think it's hilarious. They just laugh.
Laugh? Why?
Because, from their perspective, it's absurd. They say, essentially, the great king is the boss of the rivers. He is the god of rain. Who decides if it rains? The king does. How could this mortal possibly know? He's definitely going to lose. Definitely.
So they have absolute faith in the king's power. They believe he controls the reins, so any prediction by someone else must be wrong.
Total certainty. It shows their worldview, right? Power resides with the king, with their divine authority. The idea that some human's knowledge could supersede that is just unthinkable to them. The Dragon King's probably feeling pretty smug.
Ready to collect his winnings the next day.
And boom, a messenger arrives from the Jade Emperor.
Whoa, okay. From the top. The heavenly court.
Carrying an imperial edict, a direct command.
And let me guess, it's about the rain.
You got it. The edict commands the Jing River Dragon King to make it rain in Chang'an the next day. But here's the kicker. The edict specifies the exact same timing, Chen Qi, Si Shi, Wu Shi, Wei Shi, and the exact same amount, 3 feet, 3 inches, 48 points that Yuan Xiaoqing just predicted.
No way. Exactly the same.
Down to the last detail.
Okay, so the Dragon King must be absolutely terrified now.
Totally freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
He realizes Yuan Xiaoqing isn't just some lucky guesser. He somehow knew the divine plan, the heavenly court's orders, even before the official edict arrived.
It shows you just how dialed in Yuan Xiaoqing is to the celestial workings and how fixed these divine decrees are supposed to be.
Right. But does this humble the Dragon King, make him think, okay, I need to follow this exactly?
Judging by the story, probably not.
No. His pride kicks back in. He's still thinking about that wager. Losing face, losing 50 taels of gold. That seems more important to him in the moment.
So what does he do? He can't just ignore a direct order from the Jade Emperor, can he?
He consults his advisors. Looks for a loophole, maybe.
Ah, the advisors. Always tricky.
And one of them, the Shi Fish General, offers what he calls a small plan.
A small plan. That sounds ominous already.
Doesn't it? The plan is basically tweak the orders just a little bit, change the timing slightly, alter the amount of rain just enough so it doesn't perfectly match Yuan Xiaoqing's prediction.
So the idea is he fulfills the general task of making rain, but gets the details wrong on purpose.
Exactly. The advisor figures, you know, change the timing by an hour, reduce the rain by a tiny bit. Yuan Xiaoqing's prediction is wrong. Dragon King wins the bet. And surely the heavens won't care about such a minor change, right?
Oh, that sounds like flawed logic when dealing with divine law. It seems like a kind of system where any deviation is a big deal.
You'd think so. But the Dragon King? He goes for it. He agrees. Winning the bet, saving his pride, matters more than perfect obedience. A fatal choice.
So the next day comes. He makes it rain.
But not according to the edict. He puts the plan into action. Deliberately makes the changes.
And the text tells us exactly what he did, right?
Yes. He started the cloud cover at Si Shi instead of Chen Shi, thunder at Wu Shi instead of Si Shi, rained at Wei Shi instead of Wu Shi, and finished at Chen Shi instead of Wei Shi.
So everything shifted 1 hour later.
Right. And the amount, he only delivered 3 feet and 40 points.
Short by 3 inches and 8 points, just enough to make Yuan Xiaoqing technically wrong.
Precisely. Yeah. So feeling clever, feeling like he's won.
He transforms back into a scholar, goes to the fortune teller's shop.
Ready to rub it in. And he doesn't just gloat. He starts smashing the place up, breaks the sign, the ink slab, calls Yuan Xiaoqing a liar, a fraud.
Wow. All that anger because he cheated and still thinks he's justified.
But Yuan Xiaoqing, he's completely calm. Doesn't flinch. Doesn't seem scared at all.
That must have thrown the Dragon King off.
I imagine so.
Yeah.
And then Yuan Xiaoqing just looks at him and drops the bombshell.
What does he say?
He says, essentially, I know who you are. You're not a scholar. You're the Jing River Dragon King.
Ooh, identity revealed.
And then the really devastating part. And because you deliberately changed the timing and amount specified in the Jade Emperor's edict, you've committed a capital offense. You're sentenced to be executed.
Executed? For changing the rain by an hour and a few inches.
On the dragon-slaying platform, no less. That small plan wasn't so small after all. It violated heavenly law directly, the ultimate penalty.
Okay, now the Dragon King must be terrified. No more pride, just pure fear.
Absolute terror. It hits him. The scale of his mistake, Yuan Xiaoqing's power, Not just prediction, but knowing the divine consequences. He drops the broken sign, begs Yuan Shaoqing to save him.
Can Yuan Shaoqing do that? Can he just undo a heavenly death sentence?
He says no. He can't stop the execution itself, the decree is made. But he can offer a path to life, a way to potentially survive it.
Okay, a chance. What's the advice?
This is where it gets really tangled between realms. Yuan Shaoqing tells him, you're executioner. It's scheduled to be Wei Zhang.
Wei Zhang. Isn't he the prime minister? A human official under Emperor Taizong?
The very same. A powerful minister in the Tang Dynasty court. So Yan Shuxing says, go find Emperor Taizong. Now, beg him for help. Maybe the emperor can intervene with his own minister.
So the only hope is for the human emperor to somehow stop his minister from carrying out a heavenly execution. That's complex.
It really is. So the Dragon King does exactly that. That night, he appears in Emperor Taizong's dream.
In the dream.
Oh, takes human form, explains everything sentenced by heaven. Wei Zhang is the executioner. The time is set for the next day. And he desperately pleads for the emperor to save him.
And what does Taizong do in the dream?
He agrees, maybe out of pity, maybe the sheer strangeness of it. But he promises, I will save you.
A promise made in a dream, but now it pits the emperor's word against a heavenly command.
Exactly. So Taizong wakes up. The dream is vivid, unsettling. He remembers his promise.
What's the first thing he does?
Goes to morning court. All his officials are there.
Yeah.
And he immediately looks for Wei Zhang.
Wei Zhang isn't there.
He's absent, which probably worries Taizong even more. He tells his ministers about this incredibly strange dream he had, asks where Wei Zhang is.
How do the ministers react?
An official named Xu Shiji speaks up. He says essentially, Your Majesty, this dream is significant. You need to take it seriously.
And his advice?
Keep Wei Zhang with you all day. Don't let him out of your sight. Prevent him from doing whatever he's supposed to do.
Keep him busy, basically.
Right. Taizong agrees immediately. Send someone to fetch Wei Zhang right away.
Now, what's Wei Zhang been doing? Why was he absent?
Well, the story tells us he knew what was going on, too. He wasn't just late. He'd been preparing.
Preparing for what?
He was aware of the heavenly situation. He'd apparently read the signs in the stars. And crucially, he'd received his own golden edict from the Jade Emperor.
An edict for him? What did it say?
It commanded him, Wei Zhang, to execute the Jing River Dragon King.
Okay.
In a dream. It's called a Mengzan, a dream slaying. At that exact time,
sure.
Wu Shi San Ke.
So Wei Zhang has a divine duty to perform this execution, psychically, while dreaming, at a specific time.
Precisely. He was getting ready for this heavenly task. So when the emperor's summons arrives...
He's caught, isn't he? Duty to his earthly emperor, duty to the Jade Emperor.
Exactly. Fearful of disobeying Taizong, but aware of his divine obligation. He gets dressed quickly and heads to the palace.
And Taizong is waiting, ready to keep his promise to the dragon.
Yep. He talks state affairs with Wei Zhang for a while, dismisses the other officials, keeps Wei Zhang right there.
Running down the clock.
And as the time gets close to Wuxi Sanke, late Cixi, early Wuxi Taizong calls for a big chessboard.
A game of Go.
Invites Wei Zhang to play. The intention is crystal clear. Keep Wei Zhang right there in the palace, playing Go with the emperor. That's the idea. If he's with the emperor, he can't carry out the sentence.
Wow. So it's human strategy versus celestial decree.
That's exactly where we're left. It's incredibly tense. You've got this divine execution locked in for Wuxi Sanke.
You've got the emperor of China actively trying to stop it, using a board game as his weapon because of a promise he made in a dream.
And you've got Wei Zhang the executioner, stuck playing Go, torn between his loyalty to the emperor beside him and his mandate from heaven.